From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today on the program, we're re-airing a conversation about crime. And to start things off, I'm going to ask you a series of questions. These are questions the Gallup organization asked in a survey back in October. Number one, is there more crime in your area than there was a year ago, or less? And number two, is there more crime in the U.S. than there was a year ago, or less? More than half the respondents, 55%, say there's more crime in their area, and an overwhelming majority, 77%, said there's more crime across the country. But they are, quite simply, wrong, at least if we're talking about violent crime, assault, murder, etc. So why is there a disconnect? Why do we feel less safe? And what are the implications of these feelings for public policy? To talk more about this, we were joined by one of the foremost criminologists in Illinois. David Olson is co-director of the Center for Criminal Justice Research, Policy, and Practice at Loyola University Chicago, where he's also a professor. And he's chairman of the board at the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority. Because our conversation is on tape today, we're not taking calls live, but you can always let us know what you think by emailing talk@21stshow.org. All right, our conversation on crime and perception with David Olson. All right, Dave, can you begin by walking us, broadly speaking, through the story of crime in America over the past few decades?
Yeah, I think, thanks for asking me the question that way. I think it is important to understand where we've been and where we are with respect to crime broadly. Really, in the United States, we saw the highest rates of crime, both violent crime and crime involving property like thefts, back in the early 1990s. And pretty consistently since then, there's been decreases in all crime compared to the early 90s. And as you pointed out, you know, surveys that have been done of the public's perception during those periods when crime was consistently going down every single year, the majority of people in the United States perceived that crime was actually increasing. So I think that's one way to think about it is broadly where we've been over the last 2 to 3 decades is we've seen fairly consistent decreases in crime overall. It's really been the last few years where we've seen some increases in very specific types of crimes, oftentimes some of the most serious crimes that get a lot of attention from the media and as a result from the public.
You know, the word crime is so broad. Maybe you can break down some of what somebody like you who looks at these numbers and statistics, what are the different types of crimes and have there been differences, right? There's property, there's violent crime. How do you think about those numbers?
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways to think about it. One is crime is anything that the legislature has determined to be illegal. And that can range from relatively simple minor behaviors that are deemed to be in violation of the criminal law to obviously the most serious crimes like homicide. The way that criminologists generally look at crime is we tend to group them in two major categories, and that's violent crime, which involves, obviously, from what it says, violence committed against an individual, robbery, battery, sexual assault, homicide. And then there's property crime, where there is no harm to a victim, but rather their property is stolen in the case of a burglary or a motor vehicle theft or things like that. Where it gets a little complicated is people look at crimes like carjacking. Someone's car was stolen, but it involved the threat or use of force. And so we as criminologists count that as a robbery and official statistics do as well. So that's one thing is that there's those two major groups of crime. But there's also another category of criminal behavior that is only known when the police encounter it, meaning that victims don't call the police and say, for example, somebody is possessing drugs in my neighborhood, or somebody is illegally possessing a firearm. Those two are criminal behaviors, and people can be arrested for that and charged with that. But oftentimes we don't count those as part of the crime statistics because it doesn't involve a victim reporting a theft or an assault. It's only detected when the police for example, observe a drug transaction on the street, or they pull somebody over and find a firearm that the individual illegally possesses.
Well, that gets at an interesting point, because one of the things I wanted to know about is how do we, you know, the public, the government, how do we get crime numbers? And I, and maybe this is a time to ask. I noticed that they're pretty incomplete, right? I think I saw that 75% of the agencies respond to the FBI crime survey. Now, I don't know if those are just all sort of like two officer, one stoplight town sort of agencies that are not responding, or are there bigger police departments that are not responding? How do we know what constitutes crime? Go ahead. Yeah.
There's two primary ways that we measure crime in the United States. One is through what we call official statistics or officially reported crime. And that's information that the police collect and then they report on, right? In Illinois, local police departments collect information on crime that occurs in their community, and then they report that to the Illinois State Police, and that gets reported to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and that's how the FBI produces their measures of how much crime there was in the United States. And again, those tend to be, you know, property crimes and violent crimes are the standard ones that account for a lot of that. The other way that we measure crime is through what's called the National Crime Victimization Survey. One of the biggest limitations with official crime statistics that are reported by law enforcement agencies is a fairly substantial portion of crime that occurs never gets reported to the police. So there's a survey that's been done in the United States by the federal government where they kind of similar to the census, they contact individuals and do an interview and ask them if they've experienced the, you know, specific types of victimization in the past year. And that produces kind of an independent measure of crime that gets beyond just the crimes that are reported to the police, but thefts that may occur where the victim doesn't report it to the police because they don't think it's serious enough or they don't think that the police will be able to do anything. But there's also serious crimes that may not get reported to the police because the victim doesn't want to engage with law enforcement, or the victim knows the perpetrator and doesn't want to make it an official report. So those are the two primary sources of information that we have. The National Crime Victimization Survey always shows that there's more crime that occurs than what's reflected in police statistics. But what we're, as criminologists, confident about, or what we tend to see in those, is they move in the same direction, which provides us with some sense that the information is reliable. You know, when the National Crime Victimization shows that crime's going down, that's usually reflected in official police statistics as well.
Okay, so that is how statisticians such as yourself, government officials, that's how you get official crime numbers. But there's another way that most of the rest of us learn about crime, and that's through local media. Let's listen to a short montage we put together.
Two teenagers were arrested after a fight broke out at White Oaks Mall in Springfield. Springfield police say about 20 to 30 teenagers got into a fight near the food court. Two security guards tried to stop it, and two of the teens began attacking the security guards.
A woman who was stomped on and robbed on a CTA Red Line train earlier this month has died. She was found with cuts and bruises on her face after a violent robbery.
Police tell us officers were called to the 100 block of West Green Street just before 11 p.m. Sunday. According to officials, a suspect attempted to rob the 23-year-old victim before shooting him. The victim is being treated at an area hospital.
Peoria police are investigating a deadly shooting. The area is West Lincoln Avenue, just a few blocks east of Manual High. This is the River City's second murder case of 2024.
TV news reports from Springfield, Chicago, Champaign, and Peoria, all in the past few weeks. All right, Dave, so how does this sort of media coverage affect our perception of crime?
I think part of what it does is it makes us aware that there is crime occurring, and oftentimes it's some of the most serious crime that does get covered, right? So the fact that we hear about crime through the media, I think it's an important responsibility that the media has to inform the public about what's going on in their community. And I'm not, you know, and it's important to point out that all those crimes that were described are are concerning and that they involved harm to people that we prefer not to see. That said, if that's the only source that the public has of crime, then they're only hearing a little bit about what crime is actually like and what types of crimes are most frequently occurring. And those stories aren't going to give us any understanding of whether or not what's happening this week is worse or better than what happened the week before or the year before. And so I try to remind people that when we hear about a crime story on the news, it's on the news because it's an anomaly or it's extremely serious, not because it's the typical crime. Wouldn't be good news coverage or very interesting for reporters to talk about somebody's bicycle being stolen from their garage or something like that, right? So the stories we hear about are obviously going to be the most serious. And my concern oftentimes is that if that's the only source of information that the public has about what crime looks like, they assume all crime involve teenagers assaulting security staff or victims being murdered on public transportation. When that isn't what most crime looks like. Most crime looks like minor criminal behavior that involves someone's property being vandalized or taken. And as much as we wouldn't want to see that occur, they aren't involving loss of life or injury to a victim.
I'm going to put in both a good word and a bad word for some of this coverage myself here. I think a lot of it is very short. I mean, some of those excerpts you heard were almost basically the entire story. There's very little context about overall crime and what it's doing, just to focus on these individual stories. But the good word is at least those organizations presumably still have editors and journalistic standards they're trying to uphold, whereas a lot of information now also comes through social media. It's unfiltered. And who knows, whether people are listening to a police scanner or making it up or sensationalizing things. Like, the information environment is very different than it was 20 years ago, right, Dave?
Yeah. When I started my career back in the Stone Ages, you really had very few sources of information from the media. It was, one of three network TV stations or your local newspaper, and that was the extent of it. And what was covered in those generally were very localized issues. Today, we get information from multiple sources from across the country, and it's important to recognize how that's going to affect people's perceptions of crime and the criminal justice system. We'll hear about a shooting at a school in a state on the East Coast, and that'll be information that people here are exposed to. And for a lot of people, that factors into their perception of, is crime worse this year than it was last year? Because they're hearing stories from across the country. And again, they're only gonna be the most serious crimes that get that kind of coverage. So I think the amount of information we're being bombarded with about crime, and it almost seems as though it's an attempt to figure out if people can find a crime that's even more serious than the last one that was reported.
I want to share a few comments we got from listeners on this. Don sent us, we asked our texting group about this, which is text the 21st. You can join that, by the way, by sending the word talk to 217-803-0730. Don said, I feel safer overall. However, champagne has created an unsafe dynamic for the homeless and residents with no barrier shelter replacing any low barrier drug and alcohol free options. To be honest, I often feel less safe when police officers are around, for example, three units responding to a traffic stop or a 911 call to a shelter. We heard somebody else, Julia, who said some of the surrounding communities have high rates of violent crimes. I feel fairly safe where I live. I think people who claim violent crime is rising use it to negatively target people of color because they are racist. David, we need to take a break in a minute here, but I know you've thought about how, politicians can use crime stats to sort of push political agendas.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, crime is a public policy issue. Crime is caused by a lot of factors. that touch on other areas of public policy, but also society in general. I think one of the challenges when we use crime statistics or rises in crime within a political environment is oftentimes what the public's looking for and what the what legislators often can provide is a quick response. Particular crimes perceived as going up, we can quickly pass a law that makes punishment for that crime more serious. The response is quick in terms of a legislative change, but whether or not that's actually going to address the problem is not a question that we oftentimes seek to answer, right? We see a spike in a particular type of crime. We propose a new law that gets tougher on those crimes. We pass that, and then we move on to the next thing. We never determine whether or not that policy change was actually implemented, whether or not it had any impact on the problem.
But from
the voter standpoint, the legislator did something to respond to their concerns.
All right, we need to take a short break. When we return, more with David Olson. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to my conversation with David Olson, a professor of criminal justice and criminology at Loyola University Chicago. He's also the director of the Center for Criminal Justice Research Policy and Practice there. He's a longtime criminologist in Illinois, and we were talking about the fact that over the past few decades, crime has been declining. Now, there was an increase during the pandemic, but it seems to be going back down again, continuing this broadly secular trend. And yet the perception is that crime is going up, both locally and across the country. Before the break, we were talking about the role of the media in this, as well as the actual numbers on crime and how crime is measured. Our conversation is on tape today, so we're not taking calls, but let us know what you think by emailing talk@21stshow.org. Christy sent us a text message, said, feel less safe, much less safe. I think it's weird. There's not a Crime Stoppers or crime report in the newspaper. I follow a Facebook group that reports crime. And that is one of the things we talked about before the break, is how as traditional media has seen a lot of attrition and cutting in staffing and the size of the news report and the depth of the news report, social media, which is a lot of times unfiltered, has come up to fill the gap. David, I want to ask you about another aspect of the perception of crime. Last year, I heard a panel discussion where somebody who does a sort of strategy for political campaigns was talking about when a lot of people tell a pollster that they think crime is worse, what they're really thinking of is disorder, right? People getting aggressive with panhandling or public transportation that seems like in some cases it's become a mobile homeless shelter, as one writer recently put it. Talk about the difference between crime and disorder.
I think there's, like I said at the top of our conversation, there's crime that the legislature defines. It's behavior that's criminal that we've got laws for. Then there's all sorts of disorder that may make people feel uncomfortable, or that there's not appropriate either surveillance in a community or concern in a community. So to your point, homeless individuals, areas that are strewn with litter or boarded up buildings, those to many people signal that the area is unsafe, or the area is unmonitored, or people don't concern about that or aren't concerned about that area. I think that's a concern in that oftentimes we equate homelessness or litter or abandoned buildings with crime, and we think they're one and the same. It's likely that the causes, the underlying causes of both crime and homelessness and disorder in community are related, related to poverty, related to income, those kinds of things. So I think it's easy for people to conflate the two, but we need to recognize that they are distinct behaviors, that homelessness shouldn't be viewed as criminal behavior that we should punish people for, but rather a sign that individuals are in need. Whereas criminal behavior is something that obviously we recognize as crime and we expect some type of a response to address that criminal behavior.
You know, it's interesting because there was another survey result that seemed to suggest to me that people really kind of actually understand this. This is from that Gallup survey last October that I mentioned. It's one of the questions was, let me find it here. Which of the following approaches to lowering the crime rate in the U.S. comes closer to your own view? And one of the choices was more money and effort should go to addressing social and economic problems such as drug addiction, homelessness, and mental health. And the other choice was more money and effort should go to strengthening law enforcement. And it was actually 64-35 thought addressing social problems is where the emphasis should be rather than strengthening law enforcement. I thought of that as sort of a more academic way to sort of sum up what people were trying to suggest with that slogan, defund the police, a few years back. Direct that money into programs that can help people with serious untreated mental illness, drug addiction, that sort of thing. What are some of the implications for public policy, though, of this increase in perception of crime, or what do you think of that, that statistical result?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. One is, you know, people were asked what they thought should be done, just like people were asked if they think crime is going up or going down. Do people understand how much money is being invested in substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment, those kinds of things? And do they know how much money is invested in policing or the justice system, right? So I'm always a little suspect of questions like that and responses, because my sense is, just like most people don't study crime statistics to determine whether or not there's more or less crime, most people don't study the annual appropriations bill that the Illinois General Assembly passes to see how much money is being spent on these different things. But it's, you know, the way that I also look at it is, it's not one or the other. It's what's the right mix of the two, right? Mm-hmm. We need police and we need a justice system to respond to criminal behavior that's serious and that puts the public at risk. We also need to provide substance abuse treatment services and mental health services and house the homeless to make sure that individuals that are in those situations or need those services don't get involved in criminal activity. So it really is determining what's the right mix of those things to produce the best outcome.
If you're just tuning in, it's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to my conversation with David Olson, professor of criminology at Loyola University Chicago, also co-director of the Center for Criminal Justice Research, Policy, and Practice there. On top of all that, he's also chairman of the board at the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority. So we talked near the beginning of our conversation about the long-term decline in crime, serious crime, violent crime since the early 1990s. There was an increase, though, during the pandemic. What are some of the factors, as far as we understand it, that led to an increase in violent crime and in murder, especially during the early years of the pandemic?
Yeah, I think there, again, we have to recognize how we're measuring or how we're defining crime. During the pandemic, overall violent crime actually went down. And again, overall violent crime includes everything from murder, which is obviously the most serious, but it's also the rarest of all crimes, to the more mundane fights between two individuals that don't result in much physical harm, right? So overall violent crime decreased during the pandemic. The one exception was violent crime committed with a firearm, including homicides. And so, again, overall crime went down, but the most serious crimes, homicide and aggravated battery with a firearm and armed robbery with a firearm, did see an increase. And so one way that we have to understand these numbers and these patterns is individuals who are involved in criminal behavior actually do make some rational choices and decisions about what behavior they may engage in. And so the example I used to illustrate what might have been going on during the pandemic was there were individuals who commit crime for a variety of reasons. One of those is oftentimes it's their way of obtaining property that they can then sell so that they have money, money for food, money for housing, perhaps money for a substance abuse issue that they're dealing with. Right. So they have options as to what crimes they can engage in to generate income. They could burglarize someone's house, you know, break into someone's house while they're not there and steal a TV. They could sell drugs on a street corner, or they could commit a robbery. And it's likely that the changing behaviors of citizens during the pandemic, with more people at home, fewer people going out, it changed the types of crimes that individuals committed or that they had the opportunity to commit. So during the pandemic, we saw a fairly large drop in burglaries, and that makes some intuitive sense, right? If more people are staying at home, you're less likely to break into someone's house when people are there. So what other options might there be to commit those crimes? The other thing that we know happened in the years leading up to the pandemic, but also the early months of the pandemic, were the number of people buying firearms in the United States and in Illinois increased dramatically. And it's likely that with that big increase in firearms being purchased, some of those firearms made their way into the illegal firearm market and were more readily available to people who might want to use those to commit crime. So there's a lot of changes that the pandemic brought with respect to the substitution of one crime for another, but also more firearms were introduced into the illegal economy that likely made armed robberies with a firearm, for example, a crime that now more individuals could commit if they wanted to, rather than some of the other offenses.
That's a really interesting sort of substitution and a rational way of thinking about it, right? Can't break into people's houses because everybody's working from home, or a lot of people were working from home. And so instead, maybe you saw, that's one of the reasons you saw this increase in retail theft, for example, people stealing from stores. You've also spoken about there's been a lot of media attention on carjacking in the past couple of years. You hear a lot of stories about that, especially in the Chicago area. And I've heard you make the point about the changing technology, anti-theft technology in cars, maybe playing a role in that.
Yeah, I think part of what we have to recognize is the reason why people are stealing cars, for the most part, is likely remain the same. That people stole cars because they could convert that stolen car into money by breaking it down into parts or selling it or things like that. So I think that's still an overarching goal with respect to people stealing cars. Recently, with some of the YouTube available information about how you can hack into certain cars to steal them, might have fueled increases in theft of those cars just for people to see if they could do it. So the whole goal was just to see if they could actually steal the car, but they weren't necessarily intending to then break it into parts and sell it. But then another reason why cars are being stolen, which again is getting some attention, is to be used in the commission of other crimes, like what you described, where people will steal a vehicle primarily for the purpose of driving that vehicle into a storefront and then looting that store for the purposes, again, of stealing property that can then be fenced and sold to generate income. It's those latter things that get a lot of the attention, right? Someone stealing a car and driving it through a storefront in downtown Chicago gets a lot of attention. Someone just stealing a car and then, chopping it for parts and selling it isn't going to get much attention. But the underlying goal was still to generate income, right? It was to steal things to to generate property. But increasingly, the technology of cars is such that you've got to have the key fob, you know, in order to start and operate the car. In quotes, back in the day, you could hotwire a car. You could steal a car by breaking the steering column and using a screwdriver to turn the ignition. You can't do that anymore. In order to steal, you know, a new car these days, it has to be running and it has to have the key fob in it. And that, I think, is part of the reason why we're seeing carjackings occurring, is in order to steal those cars, you have to have the key fob with you, with the vehicle. And really, the only way to do that is through a carjack.
Just a few minutes left in our time together. How can we bridge this perception gap? You know, this feeling of a lack of safety that some people are experiencing, this perception that the crime is on the rise when in fact it's on the decline. How do we sort of control those impulses within ourselves?
It's a challenge. I mean, you know, again, we're bombarded every day with stories that seem to be more and more abhorrent in terms of violent crime. And it's easier said than done, but we have to recognize that we're hearing about it because it's an anomaly, because it's a rare instance. That's what's making it newsworthy. I think we also have to recognize that there are no simple fixes to any of society's most complicated problems, and crime is no different. But I feel as though over the last 30 years, incrementally, we've been implementing policies and doing things that helps us to explain why crime has been consistently going down. It's also something that we should recognize, that we should always be concerned about crime and crimes of violence, regardless of who it impacts. You know, just because it's not happening in my community doesn't mean I shouldn't be concerned about it. And what I should be concerned about is, are the responses and are the solutions that are being offered and implemented actually going to address the problem, or is it really just political cover, or is it just to appease an electorate that wants something done, and as a result, we put together policies or pass laws that may have minimal effect. The other thing, I was going to raise it with an earlier comment, is crime is only one issue that public policymakers have to deal with. And so, yeah, the survey says that people would like to see more money invested in drug treatment and mental health treatment. They also want more money invested in schools, in roads and bridges, in a lot of things. So,
and lower taxes, you know, too.
And lower taxes, right? So we want it all. We can't get it all. And so what we really want to strive towards is making sure that we're being as efficient as possible, but also as effective as possible with the limited resources that we do have available to address these problems.
David Olson is professor of criminal justice and criminology at Loyola University in Chicago. This conversation first aired in January. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.